Hey, football fans, this is Diana Rossini from The Athletic. Get the top stories in pro football snapped directly to your inbox with our latest NFL newsletter, Scoop City. Jacob Robinson and I will bring you the daily scoop of top NFL articles, posts, and podcasts every Monday to Friday. Sign up for free now at theathletic.com/scoop.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Standing Room Only podcast. Yes, I'm your host, Ben Standing, and I cover the Washington Commanders for The Athletic. It is Monday morning here in the DMV. Hope everyone is doing well. The eclipse is a couple of hours away. I got to get glasses still. This is how I would live my life. I wait to the last second for everything, and then I'm like, oh, wait, I want to do this thing. How do I do this thing? So remember, get glasses, kids. If you're hearing this afterwards, hopefully you're listening to this with your retina still intact. But should be interesting day around here. Around like 3:30 or so is when this will be getting into darkness here in a bit. So that will be interesting, as will, of course, the NFL draft, which is there's like fits and starts. There are times when all the news is flowing out. There's a Senior Bowl and combine and interviews and rumors and free agency factors in. And then there's this down period where, like, kind of where we're in now, like, yeah, there'll be a 30 visit for these players, especially the quarterbacks, but we're not going to know really anything that goes on in there. And we have to wait. And, the draft essentially starts at 2 with Washington, with the Bears presumably taking Caleb Williams. And so there's a lot to still ponder there. And that's kind of what I wanted to do, to take a different angle with our guest today. Our guy, Nick, he's got a Twitter handle, Football Insights. He's also does some work for fantasypoints.com. It's Nick like Madonna. That's what we're going with here. And what I asked Nick was, help me out here. Help my audience out here. There are a lot of charts and there are a lot of data that's thrown out for all these positions. And depending how you want to look at it and shape it, it could tell you, hey, this guy's amazing, or a different one will say, whoa, big concerns here. So I asked Nick a simple question. Tell my audience, when we're looking at quarterback, receiver, defensive end, offensive tackle, what's the stat, if you had to pick one that sort of is best defined how you would look at this position, give us that stat. And from that, we got some really interesting information from Nick about the quarterbacks. Jaden Daniels was a big part of the conversation at edge rusher. We talked about a sleeper in Braylon Trice from Washington, and then a bunch of other guys at all these spots. So we really kind of looked at what could happen with the quarterbacks, as well as players might get picked in day 2 and 3. So I think you guys will really like this conversation. In addition to that, I mentioned the other day that the Commanders, we had access to them, a few of their players over Zoom, including Terry McLaurin. I wanted to play some of that conversation that we had with Terry about, kind of looking ahead to this season, and also maybe looking back a little bit about what he thought of the Sam Howell trade. Once again, Terry McLaurin as new quarterback for week one. Every year of his career has been somebody very different. And then at the end of this, I'm going to get into a poll I put up the other day about the Wizards. What if there was a world where they could get LeBron James and Bronny James, assuming his son goes pro, would you be in favor of that if you're the Wizards? And I included, like, even if you had to trade away your lottery pick, your first round pick, the reaction was odd. And if you're not a Wizards fan, this isn't about this part of the conversation. I'm not going to break down the Wizards roster. It is, though, about how we react to ideas, thoughts on Twitter. And everybody knows Twitter is a very angry place, but this last week really kind of threw me with, it wasn't just the reaction to this poll. It was a reaction to the Stephon Diggs trade, some of the Caitlin Clark conversation, and even the conversation about when somebody like Adam Schefter puts out news, how everybody reacts to it. I don't know. I found that my goal is not to be preachy ever, but I do view my role here sometimes is to help educate to an extent. Here's how I'm viewing it from the perspective that I'm coming from as somebody that covers the team, and maybe consider looking at something in a different way. Don't just go by the norm, but actually think about it. Anyway, We'll get to that in a little bit here on the Standing Room Only podcast, which, of course, you can subscribe to on iTunes, Spotify, or anywhere you do your podcasting. By the way, speaking of that, some of you do listen to this on The Athletic, and some of you have said, hey, man, I know you're a little bit slow at times posting these, but you haven't posted anything on The Athletic in a while. I just wanted to address that quickly. I don't have a full resolution of what's going to happen, but just to be honest with you guys. So The Athletic is, obviously we do podcasts, but they're primarily focusing on the national podcast, right? You know, is the our one with the Athletic football show with Robert Mays as the primary host. And, you know, we have some other, you know, Randy Mueller and Mike Sando are part of that group. They've got one. And then there are some team sites that just have a massive following. For whatever reason, the fan base, the hosts are good, whatever. Other than that, they've really dialed back on the local podcasts, including this one. Now, as I've said before, I don't really have – it's just me doing all this. I'm the producer and all that. But because of they've sort of de-emphasized it, it's really not part of my job, just to be honest. Like, this is an extra for me, and I enjoy doing it. But because that's now sort of where we are, the extra step of putting it to the website is just for me not – It's not needed for me. It's not necessary because, again, it's not really part of my job. Obviously, you can access this podcast 100 different places, but if you're wondering about it for The Athletic, that's the issue. Now, if you subscribe to The Athletic and you, because of the podcast, do me a favor. Tell me this. Email me, bstandig@theathletic.com. I know some of you have DM'd me in the past. I have one friend of mine who yelled at me the other day, hey, why aren't you doing this? Where are the podcasts? But that's the deal. So you can listen to me, of course, all these places, until we have a different plan or a different resolution. I'm just not going to put, it's not going to be up on The Athletic. Hopefully that's not a big issue for people, but I just wanted to be transparent with that, as if you're wondering where they are at. Okay. Also, of course, you can follow me on Twitter or X at Ben Standing. And of course, make sure you subscribe to The Athletic. I will have a story. I've teased this, I think, multiple times, but I will have a story up. There's a bit of a delay, not really my issue, but, you know, I'm not the only person that works at the company. So I've asked a bunch of people, sources around the league, what do they think of the quarterbacks? So I've got some insight there. We'll get more into that in the days ahead, but that should be up Wednesday. So subscribe, you get a chance to look at that. All right. I don't think there's really any news since we last spoke. If you missed it, I spoke at length with NBC Sports analyst Chris Sims the other day. We did a really deep dive on the quarterbacks. Needless to say, Chris has strong opinions. He is big into Caleb Williams and Jaden Daniels. He is really out on Drake May. He gave great ideas and examples as to the concerns and the pros for each of the top six guys. So go check that out. We don't know for sure which one, but one of them will be joining the Commanders and presumably at the number two pick, though I still don't rule out a trade down, especially if they put themselves in position to still get one of the quarterbacks. Obviously, you could trade down to 11 with Minnesota, let's just say, and you're pretty much guaranteed that Michael Penix or Bo Nix are there. But that's not what I mean by, like, look, they could love those guys. I don't know for sure. But, like, I would think you could probably, A, get them a little bit later, and B, you know, when I don't hear too many people saying they prefer Penix and Nix over the other ones. Some, but not the most. The majority is still the other way. So, but presumably Washington's going to get a quarterback at two, and that will be obviously a seismic move here. Will also be, again, for Terry McLaurin, another quarterback. 2019, Case Keenum was the week one starter. With Terry's rookie year. 2020, Dwayne Haskins, rest in peace. 2021, Ryan Fitzpatrick, but obviously he got hurt in the first game, so really it was a Taylor Heineke season. 2022, Carson Wentz was week one. And last year, Sam Howell. And now here comes another guy, you know, whether it's Marcus Mariota week one, but, you know, the rookie, however that's going to work. It tells the tale as much about what's happened here for the last several years, because here's a guy in Terry McLaurin, debate wherever you want about where he fits in with the other receivers in this league. But he obviously is a very good player. And his stats at times, you know, felt somewhat underwhelming relative to the way we view Terry. But, you know, what's he been working with? You know, not only, of course, last year was, you know, Sam Howell essentially a rookie starter, right? But, you know, the offensive line, you know, wasn't ideal. They gave up 65 sacks. Like, he's gotten a lot of catches, right? He has, over the last, since, you know, the last 4 years, at least 77 catches of the high of 87 in 2020. But he's never had more than, he had 7 touchdowns as a rookie, but then he hasn't had more than 5 since. Last year, his yards per catch was 12.7. Like, you know, for Terry to sort of be viewed as one of the, as not just with how people revere him here, but like broadly, you know, the numbers have to be there more. And that just hasn't happened. And, you know, constantly changing quarterback is not great, let alone he's on his third head coach. This would be his, I guess if you count Jay Gruden as essentially the offensive coordinator in 2019, and then let's just for argument, and then it was Kevin O'Connell. So you had Gruden, O'Connell, Scott Turner, Eric Bieniemy, and now Kingsbury. So 5 offensive coordinators too. That's a lot of change. I just mentioned that because I, you know, when we had Terry on Zoom the other day, you know, the players were generally pretty enthused about what they've heard so far from Dan Quinn, some of the changes, they're getting used to all the new people in the locker room, that type of deal. But when I saw Terry in particular, I was like, wow, another change for this guy. I mean, we probably have all worked at places where the bosses change a lot, or your direct editor or somebody might, well, a lot of you probably don't have editors, but you know, your direct supervisor, so to speak, changes, and it can be frustrating, right? I mean, you've gotten to a rhythm with somebody doing a certain way, and then all of a sudden here comes another person who has a different view of the job or has different skill sets. And it felt like a relatable moment, I guess I could say. And so take no pity on Terry, no sympathy, you know, nothing extra like that. It is part of the deal, but it is notable that he's now going to have yet another week one quarterback one way or the other. So as I said, we had a chance to talk with players the other day, Terry McLaurin, Sam Cosmi, Tress Way, Daron Payne. I pulled out some of the audio from Terry. So let's do that. Here's some Terry McLaurin thoughts from last week. Let's listen to that right now here on the Standard Room Only podcast. Hey, Terry, obviously, first off, good to see you. Curtis no longer here, I guess.
Yeah.
What was that like, knowing that that was officially going in, and what's your sense of the room now in his absence?
Yeah, we trained at Bomberitos together, so I got to see him for the most part of the off season. And first of all, I was happy for him. Obviously, we know that this is a business, and he has to do what's best for his career and his future as well. So, you know, obviously he has familiarity with Joe Brady. He had one of his best seasons with them. So, you know, I think he's going to be a big part of their offense and continue to grow as a receiver. You know, it's a loss for our room because he's a dynamic playmaker. He can play inside and out. And just his energy, man, I think he really became one of the favorite teammates on the team because he kept things light, but he also was a really hard worker and made plays when we needed him to. So on a personal standpoint, I'm definitely going to, you know, miss him, having him in the building. And he's kind of like the guy I get to talk to, and he's like my best friend. But on the other hand, I get to see him, you know, continue to take steps in his career. He's still very young, so he has a lot of good football ahead of him.
And obviously this whole offseason is just beginning literally, but your early sense of Cliff Kingsbury, his offense, and how things may be different for the offense and for you specifically next year?
Yeah, we haven't honestly even started install yet, so I haven't even got a lay of the land quite yet. I'll probably take a look at just got our iPads within the last few days. So I'll try to take a sneak peek at what we have looking for. But, you know, I know with him talking to Zach Ertz, he does a great job of trying to get his playmakers involved, which I think we have a really good group of guys from the running backs, the receivers, and some solid tight ends as well. So I'm just looking forward to see where I fit into that. And, you know, I think with him, his biggest things is making sure the playmakers are making plays and trying to fit the scheme around that, which is always good to hear.
Hey Terry, I'm sure you, based on your career, you're not surprised that you're going to have a new quarterback this year because that's pretty much what happens every year. But how surprised were you that Sam was traded?
You never well, I don't want to say never, but it's always tough seeing like someone you build a really good relationship with go on and move on in their career, and especially your quarterback, because as a receiver you want to continue to try to build that chemistry. You know what I mean? That was only our first year playing with one another, and I feel like him and I had our we made some great plays, and we had some, you know, room for growth, and I think that comes with any new quarterback receiver relationship. And so but to see him go in a situation where we have a chance to compete and play under a really good quarterback in Geno, you know, I think he'll really like playing with receivers like well, throwing to receivers like Lockett and Jackson Smith and Jigba and DK, you know what I mean? So I think he's going in a situation where he'll have a chance to continue to show that he can play quarterback at a high level in this league, which I still truly believe in. We know this is a business, and you know, I think hopefully things work out for both sides. But I always have a lot of respect for Sam, how he handled things, good and bad, last year. And you know, I think he took a really big step in his career to continue to prove that he can play at a high level.
All right. Appreciated Terry's time. He's always really good with us. We talked, as I said, with Nick. We got into receivers and we did discuss because what the ability to get open is broadly was like a primary part of our conversation. And we did discuss where Jahan and Terry kind of fall into that, but Jahan in particular, because last year that was one of the sort of questions. Well, are the receivers not getting open, or is the lack of production a young quarterback thing, a new offensive coordinator thing? And Nick had some really interesting data on Dotson specifically, you know, at, coming out of college that I thought was notable in this regard. So just going to tease that a little bit, and we'll get to that in a moment. I don't think we have to tease the Nick conversation anymore. So let's do this right now. Here's my conversation with our guy Nick from, the Twitter handle Fantasy Insights and fantasypoints.com. All right, as promised in the intro, we're going to get into all the fun charts and other statistical analytical data that is presented by a lot of people on the Twitter. But one guy here caught my eye with the way he was presenting it. Our guy Nick, who doesn't work for Fantasy Points, he is at he's Football Insights on Twitter at FBall_insights. Nick, thanks for the time, man. How's everything going there amid the draft season?
Thanks for having me, Ben. Appreciate it. It's going really well over here. We're after the combine. We're into some of those private workouts with the teams and just counting down the days to the draft. So really excited to go over some prospects, talk about Washington, and again, really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, no, for I appreciate your time. And you know, as I told people in the intro, like part of my intrigue for this beyond like, hey, help us give some more insight into what you're seeing from the data with these prospects, quarterbacks, obviously. But I wanted to kind of start with this. Some people are certainly more analytically inclined than others. I didn't, let's just say when I took statistics in college, let's just say it wasn't helping my GPA. So even though I, you know, in terms of the map, I understand how to once it's presented to me, but like not necessarily how to, you know, how to come up with these things. But there's so many charts that, you know, so many different analysts and thinkers and outlets put out these charts. It's sometimes I look at them like I don't know what I'm looking at here because sometimes the data can just simply contradict itself, or even if it's being presented and it looks all reasonable, is does this matter? I don't even know sometimes. So what I asked you was, we can, you know, well, so I guess just first in general, like what's your, how do you look at this data? How do you present it? And how do you sort of choose what data you're looking to present?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The goal with all the charts is to just kind of compile a portfolio of numbers and really just kind of mix and match and see, okay, if someone has a strength or weakness here, how do they make up for it here? When you look at certain guys' tendencies compared to other players in the past that have come out, where do they land on that? Is there a reason that we find these clusters? Is there a reason that we don't? Vice versa. There's some charts that I think have a lot more weight or validity in terms of projection of future performance than others. So it depends like specifically on the stat. But for me, in my terms, it just helps me visualize things. And when I started making those, especially on Twitter, that some of you may have seen, started a lot with like the wide receivers and some of the skill positions. And I was really dating back over the last decade of the college ranks. And one of the reasons I like to use career data as well. You can kind of just get a overarching or higher level view on some of this stuff and, understand, okay, why I made this guy be here. Why might this guy be all the way at the top? Maybe, maybe this guy is like really standing out from the rest because of a small sample size. Maybe this guy's really standing out here because of the offense he was in or the defense he was in, whatnot. So it could be a lot of things, but once you break down like the specific stats, I think it can help you or it can help answer that question a little bit better.
Okay, so let's go into this like with the specific situation here. So quarterback, you may have heard Washington has the second pick. So there's been a little bit of talk about that. And obviously there's six quarterbacks who people are mentioning as possible first round picks, which means a whole bunch of teams and their fan bases are thinking, hey, maybe this is the guy we need to pay attention to. Maybe they're gonna get this guy or so on. So if I say to you, okay, here's the deal. Broadly with these quarterbacks, what's the one stat that you're gonna present me a chart? You're going to show me a list or something. What's the one chart for the quarterback that, without knowing, without specific to any of these guys, who whatever it is, that you would say, here's what I think based on, spent time looking at this information that seems to be, I don't know, either the most predictive or the one that thinks it sort of tells the tale the most of what it means to be an NFL quarterback.
I think to answer your question, I think one thing that we could both really agree on is that that position, whether it be analytically or whether that be through film, is the hardest to project going to the next level. Ironically, it's the most important position. So it's a million-dollar question. And in terms of the numbers, it's really hard to project. If I had to pick one, I would start with sack avoidance and handling pressure. That tends to be something that we see translates from college to the pros. Whether guys are good at avoiding sacks and whether they have a propensity to take them. Traditionally, we've kind of followed that stat that sacks are a offensive line or a team determinant stat. But what we've learned in the analytics world is that those tend to follow quarterbacks. So, of course, guys can get hit and of course, guys can eat sacks when it's the fault of protection. But more often than not, if a guy has a propensity to eat them in college, he's going to take sacks at the next level. And
Well, and by the way,
vice
just like
versa.
to your point, Sam Howell just came through here, and admittedly, I was probably a little bit slow to get to that notion of, hey, this is one of those stats that translate like rebounding in the NBA. But Sam Howell, he was a fifth round pick. He wasn't thinking too much about where things are going, but then he gets put in the starting lineup, and then you're like, oh, hey, you know what? Back in college, he had one of the worst. Stats when it came
Pressure.
to avoiding pressure, and then sure enough, the first eight games last year was like a disaster. And while everybody's blaming the offensive line, and there was something to that, it became clear that oh, wait a minute, maybe the issue is him as much as them. And so yes, we just lived through that exact scenario.
Yeah, and there's some people I talked to just last year around this time, or when Sam kind of got a little taste of the NFL towards the end of his rookie year, where I believe he started the last game of the regular season, if I'm not incorrect there. He started the last game of his rookie year,
Yes,
right, against
correct.
Taylor Heineke. He's got great film, and he looked there's times where he looks great from the pocket throwing it, but he obviously, like you said, he fell to the mid rounds or fifth round. And I think that's something that falls on the handling sacks, and that is something that's followed from college to the pros, and it's something that sticks. And I can just look up this list now. Some of the college data that I like to look at goes back to 2014, so we've got about a decade of data here, and I compile like a lot of career stats for quarterbacks, specifically first and second round QBs since the 2016 draft, and I can just rattle off some of the quarterbacks, like with this stat we were talking about, pressure to sack. That's the amount of sacks that you've taken relative to the amount of pressure dropbacks. So they call it a pressure to sack ratio on profootballfocus.com. But the correct lingo for that would be pressure to sack rate, because it's sacks divided by pressure dropbacks. But relative, just for like an understanding, a higher number is worse. Like, you don't want to have a lot of your pressure dropbacks turn into sacks, so a lower number is better. So with those first and second round quarterbacks since the 2016 draft, a good benchmark is about like 20%. Once you start getting into that over 20% range, it gets into really big red flag territory. I've seen a lot of people talk about this stat and say, hey, there's a lot of bad quarterbacks that have had good pressure to sack numbers in college, and they're right. I would argue it's more of a stat where you're identifying those red flags who have super high numbers because you haven't seen a lot of quarterbacks succeed at the next level with super high pressure to sack rates. So that list of the first and second round quarterbacks since the 2016 draft at 20% or higher goes as follows: Trey Lance, Baker Mayfield, Lamar Jackson, Joe Burrow, Zach Wilson, DeShone Kizer, Christian Hackenberg, Justin Fields, Will Levis. So you think about the hits from that list, and you got, Joe Burrow, Baker Mayfield, Lamar Jackson.
Right. Burrow is the one that feels the outlier there. Now, and obviously with the, I mean, he's one of those guys who's a tough guy. He sits in the pocket. I was, you know, and he was willing to expose himself. I was at the game with his rookie year when he got the season-ending injury.
Oh, no. Okay.
But
Yep.
other than that, like, and Lamar, that's, you know, that's his gig. He's going to hold the ball and try to find openings because he knows he can run. So that's part of his gig, but the rest of them, yeah, that's a who's who of I don't want that guy starting for my team.
Yeah, exactly. And then even with Lamar Jackson too, he had a season that really inflated that career number. He had two seasons under 20%. And so like you kind of look at this stuff and you say, okay, this is a stat, or handling sacks is a number that tends to translate from college to the pros. There are guys who have succeeded with it, but is there a way that they make up for it? It's kind of like a bigger, larger part of the puzzle, and it's just kind of going from there. So like that, and go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, so in terms of this draft, and I think I already know where this is going, and some people may not want to hear this, but in terms of this draft, it feels like, from what I recall seeing, if I think it was yours, maybe somebody else's, I don't know, but like there's one name out there that kind of stands out in that red flag territory. Am I right? At least one.
The one guy that I'd say, I don't know what the situation is with the terms of the preference of the quarterback prospects, but for any Jaden Daniels fans out there, this is a little bit of a trigger warning, but he's definitely a guy who gets a red flag mark in the stat, especially going to the next level. His career number is at 24.5%. So that's that list I just rattled off, the only person that's better than is Will Levis. So, for him, that's something that's followed him throughout all years of college. And his final season at LSU is obviously something special. Won the Heisman, was really productive, and he was great. And you can't take that away from him. That's something that's really concerning because if you break down those 5 years that he played, his best college pressure to sack rate season was that final year at 20%. And that's still kind of tough. All those, like, hits that we were just talking about from that list, Joe Burrow, Baker Mayfield, Lamar Jackson, all those guys had at least 1 year under 20%. Jaden Daniels has played 5 years in college, and not one of them was under 20%. In fact, his second to last year at LSU, or second last year to college, his first year at LSU was 30%, which is borderline unplayable. It's pretty catastrophic to an offense when you're just eating that many sacks. But there have been guys that have succeeded. I don't want to take that away. The last thing I want to do is say a guy can't do something at the next level just
Yeah.
because the position is so hard to predict. But it's a larger piece of the puzzle. And it's something with Jaden Daniels that kind of, I was able to unravel with some of the numbers and, kind of led to my concerns with him because you peel back the onion and you say, okay, pressure to sack. Guys who take those sacks are probably doing so because they're trying to big game hunt, or they're trying to find shots downfield, or they're making up for it in certain ways. Jaden Daniels obviously makes up for it with his legs. He's a great runner, and he really opens things up for an offense and really creates a lot of yards that way. But he's got a relatively low big time throw rate to go with that. Something that we've seen other quarterback prospects with those high pressure to sack numbers at least supplement it with, like Baker Mayfield, like Joe Burrow. Those guys do that, as well as middle of the field passing. Jaden Daniels hasn't really, thrown that ball in the intermediate deep parts of the field like we've seen with some of the prospects. And that's a big part of the NFL game. You're getting a lot of too high coverage, a lot of middle field open looks.
Right.
And that's something you got to be anticipatory with your throws. And the next questions you kind of ask with that are, is he throwing to capable wide receivers? Is he
Yes.
throwing behind good protection? And it's like, because that could be a reason that maybe they're not getting it there, And he, it's just this past year, threw to potentially two first round guys and played behind a pretty good offensive line. And some of the same problems still existed, albeit in our Heisman season. So you kind of peel back the onion there. Not to mention it's his fifth year of college. He's going to be 24, I believe, entering the league. There's definitely some red flags there, but there's also red flags with, I believe, every quarterback in the first round.
So,
And
yeah,
yeah,
so let's
go ahead.
broaden that out. We'll skip for argument. We'll just skip Caleb Williams since we assume he's going one. And unless they trade out, they're not going to look at Bo Nix or Michael Penix, presumably at two. So just in terms of Drake May and JJ McCarthy, then what do they show you in this stat that we're talking in this pressure to sack ratio, rate?
Yeah, they're really good. Michael Penix has got Michael Penix specifically, I believe, has one of the best numbers that in the college database, or at least in college history, going back. And obviously, Bo Nix, Michael Penix are kind of like Jaden Daniels, where they've got a ton of dropbacks under their belt at college level. So a large sample size to go with. Bo Nix is also someone who's got a really good pressure to sack number, as well as JJ McCarthy. JJ McCarthy is obviously a guy who's got a low sample size of work, but all three of those guys are a lot better in that department. Ironically, the best three quarterbacks in the draft, Caleb Williams, or like the consensus best three quarterbacks in the draft, Caleb Williams, Drake May, Jaden Daniels, all have a little bit concerning pressure to sack numbers, especially Caleb and Drake in their last season. But, if I think it's fair to look at the career numbers, kind of get a little bit more context on the situations and, just kind of look and see who struggles in what areas and who doesn't. But to answer your question, Bo Nix, Michael Penix Jr., JJ McCarthy, they've got good sack avoidance numbers. So that's something in their area I think that establishes.
And just to
Go
say, like
ahead.
in fairness to Caleb Williams and Drake May, like their teams overall clearly took steps back. And when like USC, they couldn't defend anybody. So when he's gonna pass every play, probably, you can just have
Right.
everybody just pass rush. And Drake May certainly lost pieces, his new coordinator. So no excuses, but just for context purposes.
Yeah.
So let's flip this around. So okay, that was I like that stat. I like that discussion. Give me now. So this is the point where I'm talking about where things can be contradictory. Is there one you have off the top of your head that either you know to be sort of a pro Jaden Daniels one to show, hey, okay, maybe this isn't great, but this one is? Or just what's your next stat? If we get past the sack to pressure or pressure to sack, whatever, what's the next one for you?
I would say, it kind of falls in line with just looking at some of the tendencies rather than like the stats with the quarterback. I think that
Okay.
paints a bigger picture. I think scramble rates are something that obviously you can see with your eyes on TV. He's running all over the place and he's an incredible athlete. He can really be a defensive destroyer with his legs, especially if those defenses are trying to take into account those great wide receivers. He's able to chop up 20, 30-yard runs. The scramble rates are something that are pretty consistent going to the next level. I think it's something that it helps you look at film and say, okay, we can look at scramble rates. I want to look at scrambling from a clean pocket versus when they're under pressure. Are they bailing from clean pockets because no wide receivers are getting open, or are they bailing under pressure because they've given all their reads, they've given all their shots, and now they're just taking off? Or is this something where like they're scrambling after quick pressure, or is this something because they're scrambling after they're inviting pressure, holding on to the ball for 3.5 seconds? Something that we've seen, Justin Fields do in college and seen translate to the next level. It's something that we've seen Caleb Williams do in his last year, and I'd say that's his biggest concern there. The scramble rates are something to me that tell a story. Caleb Williams is a guy that, he has some tough pressure to sack numbers at certain times, but his scramble rates from a clean pocket, for example, aren't some, they're not super high. They're under 5%. You see guys in recent classes like Trevor Lawrence, CJ Stroud, Bryce Young, Brock Purdy. Those guys are all under that number. Guys who are over that number, you go to Justin Fields in this class, you have Drake May, you have Jaden Daniels. It kind of peels back the onion there where you're like, okay, are they taking off because maybe their legs are a part of their game set, their skill set, it's something that translates to the next level. Okay, that's great. If not, is it because they're missing reads? Is it because they're bailing out of the pocket too early? Those are the kind of the questions it leads to. And so I think the scrambling is also something to supplement with that, because guys who tend to scramble a lot in college and also take sacks, we see tend to take a lot of sacks at the next level. Even with a Lamar Jackson and a Jalen Hurts, for example, guys who took sacks and scrambled in college but have been successful at the next level, they've still taken sacks. So it all kind of leads back to the sack numbers for me, but the scrambling is another tendency where it's like, okay, what do we know about their game that's going to at least buy them some time to develop in other areas? One guy that's a great example or a testament to that is Anthony Richardson from this past draft. He has great pressure to sack numbers. Fantastic job with sack avoidance, all with great athleticism and a big arm and an ability to create with his legs. In my opinion, I think Indianapolis drafted him super early last year because they could rely and bank on some of those things for the first few years while he developed as a passer. So I think Anthony Richardson is a great example where, okay, he's got these tools in his toolbox that we can use, while we develop him in these other areas over the duration of a rookie contract, along with a good head coach and play caller and Shane Steichen. And that's the plan of attack. Works, it works. If it works, it doesn't. It's a sound process. That's something that I really like. And I think that really explains or kind of puts together just some of the skills and the tools and everything that goes into it with the quarterback evaluation.
Yeah, I mean, when there's I talk a lot about should you how quickly should you play a rookie? I'm somebody who like who would prefer to sit, but needless to say, I've not been in the room. And when you talk to some people in the league, I had Chris Sims on the other day. He was like, no, play the kid, whatever, without knowing any context, play the kid and get the go from there. But when you have somebody who's mobile, that's the advantage of that type of player, I think, initially, because at least they can get themselves out of trouble. And if they know how to do what you're saying and avoid sacks the way it sounds like Richardson can, then it doesn't screw up the. I was about to use the F word. You don't screw up the rest of the team. You're still able to at least be functional within some sense. And then as time goes on, now you get the guy to be more comfortable in the pocket and look seeing down the field. So that is a key.
And guys, too, sorry, I didn't mean to
No,
interrupt you
you're
there,
good.
but some other tools of guys that we've seen do that in the past are Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes. Those guys had good pressure to sack numbers in college, had big arms, and can obviously use their legs when they need to. And there's some, with another quarterback in this draft, Drake May, there's a guy that, he's got some tough film at times. He's got some inconsistent footwork, some inconsistent mechanics that leads to some wild throws, albeit with a really strong arm. But at the same time, you see with some of these great quarterbacks, you look at their college tape and some of those same things were happening. So when you're looking at the quarterbacks, I think it's more of a higher level or reading between the lines and say, okay, this quarterback could have dropped back this many times per game with a lesser roster, constantly trailing with defenses knowing that you're trailing and giving you certain coverages every single time. Deal with that. Here you go. I think if any quarterback was in those situations, they're going to have a lot worse or negative game film than some of the other guys who didn't play as much, who were in certain game scripts and were getting certain looks when they were dropping back to pass because of the personnel they had on the field, because of the looks their defenses were giving, throwing to open guys, et cetera. So even guys like Mahomes and Josh Allen, like they were in situations like a Drake May or Caleb Williams where they weren't playing with some of the best rosters, and it was the Wild West out there, dropping back, long dropbacks. And I think some of the teams and some of the quarterback evaluators like to see a guy under duress and what they can do there, because their situations in those cases are only going to get better at the next level. And I think that's just, it makes guys' eyes pop who are looking at these quarterback prospects, because they're projecting, 2, 3, 4 years down the road. It's not something that's right away. It's just
Right.
looking at the tools in the toolbox and saying, okay, what can this guy eventually become? And I
When
guess getting there, to your point, is it's like, okay, should we sit, it's getting to that point. Is it best to sit the guy or is it best to play him? And I think that's like a super important question too. It's just super hard to answer, but it's still an important part of the process.
Yeah, no, for sure. And when I talk to people around the league about the quarterback, that's almost the number one selling point they have when it comes to Caleb Williams. He can make the fun Mahomes-ish in th throws. He's got the arm. He's got a lot of stuff. But it's that fact that they have seen him play under such duress and his ability to get out of it that's what like they almost promote his floor more than they promote the upside because of the fact that he's shown the ability to get out of trouble and still be functional and not just like cave under that pressure and duress. I do want to talk about other positions, but just last thing on the quarterback. So I've asked you about a couple individual stats. Now, when you look at the whole portfolio, you have access to all these different numbers and stats, and obviously you have eyeballs too. But in terms of like the data to a degree, how do you kind of see the order of these quarterbacks?
It's a great question. You know, just kind of projecting, you know, in a raw sense, I can give you an answer to that. I think I'm pretty consensus with what you see nationally. I think Caleb Williams is the first quarterback off boards. If I were making a list, I would probably have Drake May at 2, Jaden Daniels at 3, JJ McCarthy at 4, followed by Bo Nix and Penix, either order. I'm not, you know, gung-ho on that order, because I think a guy like JJ McCarthy, for example, who's got experience in some NFL concepts, who's got some experience under center in college, is a guy that, you know, could go to a Shanahan system scheme where they're running the ball a little bit heavier, who's, you know, slowing things down. I think that could really benefit a guy like that. And I think he would be a lot, or at least be a lot more successful right away, as opposed to dropping back a ton at the next level, something that he wasn't, at least we haven't seen in college. So I'm a lot more confident in a guy like Jaden Daniels, a guy like Drake May or Caleb Williams to just, you know, go out there and drop back a ton and just, you know, see what they got right away, as opposed to some of those other guys who have been a little bit protected. And so a guy like JJ McCarthy, just to answer your question, his numbers look good. Just not a lot. We haven't seen a lot in college. You know, him and Jaden Daniels really weren't in the top 10 buzz at this time last year, and even going into the season. It was Caleb Williams and Drake May for the most part as the consensus quarterback one, quarterback two, but obviously those other two guys had some really nice seasons with Heisman and national championship. So those, you know, they have numbers that look nice, but I think in terms of the context, there's still certain, you know, certain things that I think would benefit guys and just their overall development, or at least hitting the ground running at the next level. But the data points to those guys, I think the back half of that quarterback list, JJ McCarthy, Bo Nix, Michael Penix, I think that they've got numbers that show that they've got a pretty nice floor. Penix and Nix have a lot of dropbacks at the college level. They've been in multiple offenses and they avoid sacks. And I think that you're going to see some teams that, you know, aren't in full rebuild with their rosters, but are willing to poach a first round pick or a second round pick on those guys. And I think you can see them play right away and have a hard time seeing them absolutely bust through the roof. But the upside is the question there. So I think that's where you kind of segment that list. You know, you got Caleb, Drake May, Jaden Daniels as guys that, you know, you're building to be your cornerstones, even JJ McCarthy, and some of those other guys are more so steering the ship.
Okay. All right, let's get into some other stuff. And, you know, I'm just going to spring this on you since we're talking about certain charts and to help educate or supplement the conversation and to promote your work. If you're cool, like I would maybe say these charts, what we're discussing, you'll send me those charts and I'll add it to the tweet that I use with the podcast. That way people can follow along with the charts. Perfect. As well as, like I said, promote your work if that's kosher with you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. So let's go to some of the other positions. I'm looking specifically at stuff where maybe with the Commanders having those two high second round picks, I'm curious about, but I know receiver is one that you have taken a lot of interest in. And I'm sure that's, you know, look, there's three guys who may go in the top 9, 10, somewhere in that range. And then there's a bunch of guys who could be there for Washington early in round two, a Donnie Mitchell from Texas, right? Texas.
Yeah.
Xavier Worthy, who ran the fastest 40 time out there, and Ladd McConkey and some others. But just in general with receiver, sort of the same question that I asked earlier, what's that one stat, if you had to, you know, I know this isn't how the game works, but if you had to drill it down to present what you think is most important at receiver, what's that one stat that stands out?
I would say that one stat for receiver is yards per route run. So it's just to explain that stat for anyone who's not familiar, if you think of like yards per target or yards per reception, obviously that's receiving yards divided by their targets, or receiving yards divided by receptions. Yards per route run is just the yards divided by the amount of routes run. So whether that be on the game level or through the season, good numbers with that relatively, whether that be college or the pros. Anything over two is something that would be considered at least, pretty good. Anything over two and a half, three is something that's really good, if not great. A guy like Puka Nacua from last year's wide receiver class, he led that entire draft with career yards per route run at the college level. He was at over three. I think Jaxon Smith-Njigba was number two on the yards per route run number. So that's the one stat I would look to, especially with wide receivers getting drafted towards the upper parts of the draft or with good draft capital. That's something that can really really put a red flag on your profile, is if you've got a low yards per route run number and how efficient you were when you were on the field.
Okay, so give us that for this draft. Who's somebody that stands out, on the positive end of that, and who's somebody that, especially again if it's somebody maybe in the range of the 30, around 30 or so, that stands out in either way.
Yeah, so the guys towards the top of the draft, just for reference, just because Marvin Harrison Jr., Malik Nabers, Rome Odunze, the draft kind of starts there with the wide receiver group. Their yards per route run numbers are, Marvin Harrison 2.98, Malik Nabers 2.83, Rome Odunze 2.5, which are all good numbers. Getting into that part of the draft, some wide receivers in this class that have good yards per route run numbers: Troy Franklin 2.63, Ladd McConkey 2.54. Javon Baker is a guy that I like, and I don't know where exactly he's at in terms of mocks and where he's getting mocked to. But if he's a day two guy and he's going to your team, I think that's really nice. He's at 2.53. Tez Walker's 2.52. Jamari Thrash 2.52 out of Louisville, and then Jacob Culling out of Arizona 2.55. Those are all guys who've got good numbers in those categories. Some red flags in those categories who, are obviously garnering pretty high draft capital right now. Brian Thomas Jr., 1.95, not too good. Adonai Mitchell, 1.68, not too good. Keon Coleman, 1.87, not too good. Xavier Legette, 1.75. Jalen McMillan, 2.04. Ricky Pearsall, 1.99. So just want to rattle that off really quick just to give a little perspective on where guys are at. A
Yeah,
lot of the
no, that's
first-round
great.
receivers, well, I think evaluating the receivers, especially towards the upper parts of the draft, it's more about having guys hit a lot of thresholds and a lot of floors and making sure they qualify there, rather than saying, okay, I like what this guy can do on film, or I like what this guy can do on in a limited number of reps I've seen them. I think that's the easiest way to run into trouble at the position. I think a lot of the great receivers that we see in today's game that we have access to their college data, like, they all cleared, they're all really good at this number, especially in the upper parts of the draft. It's hard to find a really good receiver in rounds one or two that had a yards per route run below two. So Ryan Thomas Jr., A.D. Mitchell, and Keon Coleman, like, those are guys that are getting mocked first, second round right now that I definitely have some red flags on. I don't think it's a coincidence that you've seen wide receivers from recent classes and even last year succeed, whether that be in any round, just because they have an ability to be efficient when they're on the field and an ability to get open. You see guys like Puka Nacua, Rashee Rice, Tank Dell, all succeed at the next level with a ton of routes under their belt in college, but also being efficient when doing so. So that's something that I like to look at. If you're drafting a rookie quarterback like Washington's going to be doing, the last thing you want to do is surround them with guys who are struggling to get open when they're on the field, who are struggling to be efficient when they are on the field. You saw Bryce Young kind of deal with that in Carolina, and all the power forwards he was dealing with in that Washington or that Carolina wide receiver room. It really made life pretty tough. When you're dropping back a ton, you're constantly losing. Your offensive line isn't really holding up, and you're trying to find guys who aren't getting open. Give
Yeah,
me any
no.
quarterback, they're probably going to struggle in that situation. So I see that. I think of that, and I think a Washington situation. Curtis Samuel is obviously out the door. You have Terry McLaurin. You have Jahan Dotson. I don't know what the consensus, thoughts of are with Jahan Dotson a few years in now, but I would imagine it's not, where people expected it to be. There's also questions at the quarterback position, so it's like a, what came first, chicken or the egg type of
Right.
thing. But Terry McLaurin's obviously a true X. Wide receiver one in that offense. I think it would be nice to add some guys who just, get open. Some guys who are just nice safety blankets for a rookie quarterback. I think it's a nice strategy from a team building perspective to really pamper your rookie quarterbacks and make life as easy as possible. It's the best way to evaluate them too. You want to give them as many tools as possible to succeed, and know once you're a few years down the road, okay, this guy's had more than enough to work with. Are they succeeding or are they not? Or have we given them enough? The last thing you want to do is to be in a situation like, I don't know, let's say the Bears, where those first few years, it was, they didn't really surround Justin Fields with much, struggled. They surrounded with some better stuff this past year, and you were still kind of like at a standstill. In my opinion, you had to move on from him. The rookie quarterback contract thing is legit, and you had to move on, right? But at the same time, it's like you had those first 2 years, and you really didn't know where you're at in the evaluation process. You didn't really have anyone to throw to, and that's something that you want to avoid with a high pick like Washington has.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I've been saying that, from a needs list perspective, and you wouldn't know, but because no reason to be paying attention to me all the time for doing what you're doing. But my view for all this is everything they're doing in terms of transactions with free agency and is about just getting through the 2024 season. After that is when they'll start looking to make moves going forward. But like they just signed a bunch of veteran type guys to 1 year deals. They just had to build up the roster to help, in some case, the rookie quarterback. They have not really addressed the receiver position though. And I've been calling for guys with size because McLaurin and Dotson are both, basically 5'11", 6 foot. They don't have a size. They also don't necessarily have a burner either. So either one of those could be a way to go. So I do think that I don't know if I would rank it top two, but there's a decent chance that they go receiver, if not in that second round, then in the third. By the way, with regards to Jahan, and if you don't have it, that's fine. But in terms of getting, the stat we're talking about here, do you have any data for him coming out, or even what he's done in the pros? Because one of the issues last year was the receivers don't look like they're very open. I know ESPN has that open catch stat, and both McLaurin and Dotson seem to rank at least bottom half of the league, and maybe even more significantly down for Jahan. But again, essentially a rookie quarterback, a first-time offensive coordinator. This team just wasn't very good, overall. It was hard to, we talked about the sacks, all that stuff. But whether they were them getting open enough themselves has been a question. But if you don't have it, that's fine. But I figured I'd ask.
And from the college level, I had some of his numbers. I was a little bit lower on him coming out than others. I still thought he was a good receiver out of Penn State. But just to kind of tie in with the yards per route run number, every first round receiver since 2019 has beaten the 2.0 yards per route run threshold. Brian Thomas, A.D. Mitchell, Keon Coleman are guys who haven't. They would be the lowest career number since Jalen Reagor at 2.08, Jahan Dotson at 2.11, and N'Keal Harry at 2.12. So those latter three guys are at the lowest career yards per run of the first round receivers since 2019. Just to give a little perspective, kind of tying on the Jahan Dotson career numbers, I think at the NFL level, there's guys who like Jahan Dotson. I think there's a lot to like about his route running ability. The size is definitely something that's, from a characteristic standpoint with that wide receiver room, something you want to add in the draft. I think Jahan Dotson has also been in a tough situation where, you're in an offense that's not really winning. You're constantly seeing certain coverages from certain defenses that know you got to drop back and pass. Sam Howell specifically last year wasn't under center a lot. He was dropping back shotgun and just, running personnel. And it makes it hard. It really makes it hard to be creative on offense and get guys open when you're constantly doing that. You're constantly facing certain coverages and you have a quarterback that's taking sacks. It's pretty hard to be productive in that situation. So I don't want to write the ticket off on Jahan Dotson completely. At the same time, I think it has been a little bit underwhelming over the first 2 years. And just to agree with you on that last point, I do think it would be important for them to address wide receiver, at least, on day two. So.
Yeah, no. It's in terms of the type of receiver that they might take, I think it's important to figure out, what do you make of Jahan and to some extent
and
Terry.
Also too, you're going on about the size and you want a burner. I think that's absolutely important with the new offensive coordinator there and Kliff Kingsbury, a guy who ran a ton of screens in college. You know, obviously Coach Mahomes at Texas Tech, but Caleb Williams at USC was the offensive coordinator there for a year. And it was just a ton of screens, a ton of quick passes like that, especially early downs. And you need those guys. You need those guys with burners. You need those guys who succeed after the catch if you're going to run that type of offense, and you get the ball out quick. So that is really important. And I think that's something that they'll have to address.
Okay. And then just lastly, so I'll do dealer's choice here. Offensive tackle, they've got to get one, you know, left tackle just for the long term. And, they, you know, they have a plug and play guy, but they don't have a – or not plug, but they have a fill-in guy right now, Cornelius Lucas, but not a long-term answer. And at edge rusher, they signed a bunch of guys, you know, that'll fill in the gaps, but no real – you know, future star talent there. I'll go, you, we can do them both if you want, but if you just want to pick one, what, which one of those do you want to go to? Or do you think you have the better, you know, feeling or maybe a guy just to sort of stand out, whatever it is, which one of those two do you want to go to?
I'd go either one. I think I've been looking into some of the offensive tackles and the edge and the defensive interior prospects recently, at least more than years past.
Okay.
And
so,
I think in Washington, oh, go ahead.
No, it's good. So just offensive tackle, you know, this is a town that was raised on the hogs, so people are, you know, a little more jacked up for the offensive linemen than others. It seems like there's like 7 to 8 guys who are possibly getting picked in that first round range, maybe 9 if you count the BYU kid. But it feels like there's a pretty big drop off after that as we look at like the broader ranking. So if they want to get one, not saying you can't get one later, but it's kind of, it feels like there's a little bit of a drop off the way I look at some public rankings. So they may even have to trade up to ensure they get one. But how do you kind of view like where they're picking at 36 and 40, or, you know, how do you think there's, what do you kind of see about these tackles, you know, in that general range?
It's pretty crazy when you go down the list, like you were saying, like there's possibly 8 or 9 tackles that are going the first round, which is absolutely crazy. It's such a loaded class, but in that range, or at least Washington could get on day two. I don't know exactly where he'll be. My hunch is that he'll be on day two, but a guy to look out for is Patrick Paul from Houston.
The brother of a Commander's guard, Chris Paul.
Yeah. He's, I don't know. I don't think he's going day one. I could be wrong. I'm not as familiar with some of the trench guys, but in terms of the numbers, he really pops in certain categories. You know, you can track pressure rate. You can track just PFF grade. But one thing that they look at stat wise that has really interested me is true pass sets and looking at guys who have done reps in those. True pass sets tries to isolate, like, you know, it tries to remove quick dropbacks, scheme dropbacks, so screens, play action, plays with less than 4 pass rushers, and just really isolate a guy and see how he is in those true, you know, late down situations. Patrick Paul has got some really good numbers in those scenarios. And if you're Washington and you're drafting a quarterback, it's, you know, very likely going to be Jaden Daniels, Drake May, you know, to a lesser extent, JJ McCarthy, but obviously one of those three guys is probably going to be the pick. You know, the first two of those, Drake May, Jaden Daniels, have obviously had some trouble taking sacks at times in college. You know, you're on a team where you're, like you said, you're just trying to get to the 2024 season. You don't expect that much. They're probably going to be losing and dropping back a lot. You want a guy who's got a lot of reps, you know, in those true pass sets, or at least in those true passing downs. Patrick Paul has a career 4.2 pressure rate allowed in those true pass set reps. Joe Alt is at 3.8. Oleh Fashanu is at 3.5. So those guys who are obviously going early round one are just a little bit better than Patrick Paul. Troy Fontenot is at 6%, so he's worse than Patrick Paul. In terms of like career weighted true pass set pass blocking grade, Patrick Paul is at 82.2, which is the best in the class. And he's got a lot of reps in college in Houston. So he's older. You know, there's obviously other parts with it, and there's reasons that he's not going to be going with all those other guys in the first round. But if he isn't, he's there for Washington day two. I think that's a guy that's just proven in college. Like, you know, he's able to handle those situations, and it could be a good value.
What stat did you say was he the best at of this group?
Yeah. So weighted. So PFF obviously has their grades: pass blocking grade, run blocking grade. I can send you this chart, but I'm looking at just career numbers in those situations, and his career weighted true prep pass set grade is at 82.2, which is the best in the class. The next closest looks to be Olufoshana, who's at 80.4. JC Latham from Alabama is at 79.3. Kingsley from BYU is at 78.9. Joe Alt's at 77.3. Troy Fontenelle is at 75.2. I can send you the chart too as well. That's just weighted. That's taking their entire career grade in those true pass sets and weighing it by, like, how many reps they had each year of college, and giving more weight to the years with obviously more dropbacks or reps in those situations. But yeah, I think Patrick Paul is a guy that has succeeded in those situations, and I think that has translated more in terms of just trying to eliminate some of the quick dropbacks. In college, you have some offenses that are really schemed up and really get the ball out quick, and you don't know how many reps or how often certain guys were truly in one-on-one pass blocking situations. So Patrick Paul stands out there to me, and he's a guy that first came to my mind when I was looking at some of the numbers with the offensive tackle prospects. And keeping in mind that there's obviously going to be a huge list of guys that go early, and trying to find some sleepers in the draft. So.
Okay, this is awesome. Then so just lastly, if you gotta do it really quick, so edge rusher, they're obviously not likely in position to get a Dallas Turner or Jared Verse, but you've got guys like Chop Robinson, who could be there early day two. You've got guys who are a little bit later, Braylon Trice. I'm kind of interested by the Marshawn Nealon kid, but whatever it may be, somewhere on at least by on day two, I would imagine they get an edge. Who kind of stands out to you, sort of in that same range we're just talking about offensive linemen, or maybe even a little bit later? Is there an outlier for you? And what's, I guess, the stat that you're looking at that shows that?
Yeah, so I like one guy that you've rattled off there that's going to be available, that I think could be a good pick, is Braylon Trice out of Washington. If you look at a stat from PFF, it's called pass rush win rate. So it's a stat that's charted by them. They watch every down and every play, and they chart these things. And so it can obviously be subjective to a certain sense, but if you're looking at career numbers, you can look at career pass rush win rate in true pass sets, which we were just talking about. And Braylon Trice has a 30.9% career pass rush win rate in true pass sets, excuse me. If you just to give a little background or what makes that number relevant, here are the college edges with a 30% win rate or higher in true pass sets since 2014, minimum 275 opportunities. Joey Bosa, Chase Young, Trey Hendrickson, O'Shane, Exims. So that's a pretty good list, and that's a stat that's really isolating those, like, true passing down situations. He's really succeeded in those, and he's a guy that's going to be available on day two. I think he's got some injury or medical history in the past. Could be wrong, and obviously an older prospect, but like you said, like, some of those early edges are going to go, and Chop Robinson, Jared Verse, Braylon Trice. Those guys could be in play for Washington. If you're looking at day two, Braylon Trice is a guy that I think could be a good value.
I was at the Washington Utah game this year. The Commanders were playing the Seahawks the next day, and so
Okay.
we went. And there was obviously a lot of good players, playing for Washington. Odunze had like two really long touchdowns, but I remember watching Trice. I think it's because I think at that point they had already traded Chase Young and Montez Sweat, or I think so, or whatever. Anyway, yeah, they were at least one of them was going to come back. And yeah, Trice really stood out to me. You could just see him out there as a real presence, and yeah, I've been he's one of those guys that definitely have been thinking, could he go with that early second? And you try to look at compare to some of the other big boards out there, and it's he's sort
Yeah,
of some he's somewhere in there.
and I can send you some of the charts too. I don't know if you had a chance to look through them, but I put a few edge charts out there. And just looking at, like, pass rush win rate and pressure rate generated, or just career grade in some of these stats, and Braylon Trice, just like Chop Robinson or Jared Verse, they're up there or even better than some of the edge rushers like Dallas Turner, or they're not up there with Louis, excuse me, I don't know how to pronounce his name, from UCLA.
Yeah.
But he's there, this edge class, there's the trenches on either side of the ball. Really good class, and I think there's definitely some value to get for Washington on either side on day two, or picking a little bit later.
Dude, this was great. I really appreciate it. At fball underscore insights, you can read Nick on fantasy points. And like I said, a lot of people put out information. I just enjoyed the presentation, and now even more so after the conversation about these guys. As I said, I'll tweet out when Nick sends over to me the some of these charts that we just discussed. I'll tweet that out with the podcast so you can have the visual to listen as we're talking through this. I really appreciate it, man. I hope we can talk during, after the draft, during the season as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate having me on. Would be glad to, and hope Washington fans are happy with who the team selects. So
Well,
appreciate that.
nobody's ever happy about anything. So, no, I suspect that won't be the case, but I appreciate it, man. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Really enjoyed that conversation with Nick. And, look, he's not the only one, of course, that put this information out. All the, a lot of the analytical sites do, of course, and individual writers. But I was just, like I said, I was just sort of drawn to the way he was presenting it. And I it wasn't a lot. It was just sort of like, here's the facts, ma'am, kind of deal. But it was presented in a way that felt digestible. And I would suggest go follow Nick on Twitter, and get a feel for this data regarding these players and the good comparison points to other players who've just come out in recent years. And we will keep plowing through here as we discuss it. But it's good to discuss these guys beyond just the tape work. All right. Last thing. I mentioned the Wizards poll that I proposed the other day on Twitter. It was so if you don't know, for those of you who don't pay attention to the Wizards, and again, this isn't about the Wizards. This is about just the conversation that we all have at all times about sports. And so the other day, LeBron James's son, Bronny James, freshman guard at USC, announced that he's putting his name into the draft. He's also looking at the transfer portal. So we don't know if he's going to come out or not. But what's interesting here is, of course, LeBron James has in past said that, hey, I want to play with my son. I'm going to try to stick around until that happens. And, Bronny James had gotten a lot of attention through the years as he's gone through high school. And I've heard people say, yeah, he could potentially be a first round pick, maybe not a lottery pick or anything, but like a first round pick. I was actually at his first game. He had a bit of a heart condition that held him out for a bit. It was a little bit scary. So I happened to be in LA right before the Commanders played the Rams, and he was coming back, making his debut. So I went and, sitting there in the stands, eating my popcorn and such. You could see he understands how to play the game. There's some smarts there. And, but, overall, as an overall prospect, he's not a first round pick, not now at least. So, this idea that LeBron is going to wait around to play with him brings up the question, okay, so if he's not going to be a lottery pick and he's just going to be picked somewhere, and LeBron James is, in fact, wants to go play with his son, LeBron James, he's got another year left on his deal with the Lakers, but there is an opt out. Now it's like a $50 million contract. So presumably whoever would get him next to be opted out would have to be paying, a lot of money. But the question was, if you're the Wizards and you have the opportunity to bring in LeBron James and do it with his son, a storyline that would even add to the LeBron, legacy and talking points. If you're the Wizards, would you do it even if it cost you your lottery pick? In other words, to lock in Bronny James, and if the Wizards let's just say they pick third, would you do that too? Would you take the kid knowing you could get LeBron at least for a year? Now, that probably wasn't the best way to phrase it. I probably could have said, hey, what if they trade down from three to wherever and get extra stuff and then use one of those picks on this kid? But the larger point was, what would you do? There used to be these commercials, what would you do for a Klondike bar? What would you do for an organization that is a complete afterthought, not just in the NBA, but in the world of sports? Hell, they're an afterthought in this town. And I say that as somebody who cares about the coverage and of this team, right? I don't like that, but that's just the reality. They are coming off a situation where the owner just embarrass himself with this whole arena deal where he ended up having to, go back to DC instead of these grandiose plans for Virginia. This is also a draft that is being viewed as historically maybe the worst in modern times, and at least compares unfavorably with the 2013 draft, which is famously one where Anthony Bennett was the number one overall pick. He flamed out immediately. And then the other guys at the top, Victor Oladipo, Otto Porter, who, you know, injuries kind of messed with him here in Washington, among other things. Cody Zeller, Alex Len, Nerlens Noel. Yes, Giannis Antetokounmpo was in the draft, but he was picked 15th. I mean, the reason when people say a bad draft, they're talking about you're gonna potentially blow a lottery pick on a guy that you're not really sure yourself if he's worthy of being picked 1, 2, or 3, or you can get the same type of guy or picking at 15. That's when people say bad drafts. You just don't know. And so maybe this is the time to do it with all that uncertainty, and they have another first round pick late in the first round. Maybe it is a better way to approach this. So this was about being open-minded, and this was also about a little bit of having fun, because it have 817 steps to get from the point where the Wizards could even do this. And it's one thing to say, you put some thought into it. Boy, that would be interesting, getting LeBron James, right? Even if it's at the very end of his career, the amount of attention the Wizards would get, the amount of positive attention the Wizards would get. By the way, nothing's happening here. The draft is important, and sure, they've gone into that rebuild mode, but would you at least consider it? Now, I had friends who told me they voted no, don't get LeBron, take the lottery pick. But I even know, just based on who these friends are, that they wasted their time to answer my poll question, showed that there was it was some interesting kind of thought there, and there was some positive reaction. But the negative thought was like off the charts. And I've talked to some of those people since on Twitter and think I helped explain where I was coming from. But the broad idea was the Wizards are now in this rebuild mode, and they're all don't mess up with LeBron. That's completely opposite of what they're doing, or it just makes no sense. Forget the fact that I was just throwing out an idea, which, again, the odds of it happening are infinitesimal at this point. The kid has to declare. LeBron has to want to opt out of L.A. They have to just look at all their other options. There's not that many teams in the NBA who would actually be able to make that work, because they wouldn't have the salary space to pay LeBron. And honestly, some probably just wouldn't want the sort of extra headache that comes with LeBron. I would say, even for me, the point would be, if the Wizards moved heaven and earth to make this work, I would say to LeBron, but just to be clear, you can leave your GM hat in Los Angeles. Like, we're not going to be signing, some 30-something-year-old to a multi-year deal because you want him. Or we're not going to trade 3 picks to get James Harden or Austin Reeves or whatever. I'm just making that up, right? Now, that's the part where it probably falls apart, where LeBron would be like, if I'm going somewhere, we're going to make this work. But who knows? He plays with this kid. Maybe he's willing to sacrifice some other things. But even for the group that says, hey, this doesn't make any sense where they're going, I can make the argument that it does, right? In this regard, I have been, a Bullets Wizards fan my entire life. And in that entire time, they've signed essentially zero free agents of note in their prime of anything along those lines to come here. Gilbert Arenas turned into one of those guys, but that he was 2 years in the league. He wasn't that guy. He was an interesting free agent, but he was not, he was not what agent zero yet, right? Paul Pierce, that was the most fun I've had covering a team for a year. He came here and he was fantastic, but he came here at literally the very end of his career. He tapped out he played a little bit more after the Wizards, but he basically tapped out there. They don't get those guys. They overspend for people like Jan Mahimi, but they don't get those guys. There's a stink here that is beyond, it's not a Ted Leonsis thing. It's bizarre. But there's a stink here, and people don't want to come here. Despite, this isn't Sacramento, no offense. This isn't Memphis, no offense. This is the nation's capital. This is a big area. Like, if you're just in a big city, this is a good place to go. Nobody comes. Well, if LeBron did, right? Is that a Paul Pierce thing? Like, where it's just like 1 year and there's nothing else that happens after that? Maybe. No matter what the plan is, management can't screw it up, and management screwed up a lot before. A lot of people point to the Michael Jordan thing and say, well, if it didn't work for Michael Jordan, why would you want to repeat it? Good example of not knowing what you're talking about. The issue with Michael Jordan wasn't the player. He was still really good. The issue was the GM. Michael Jordan, the GM, was the mess. He drafts Kwame Brown number one, a kid coming out of high school, to play with him. If Michael Jordan is going to play, my stance at the time, and I do remember it, was another draft. That was the first draft, right, where the high school kid gets picked first. And it was not a great draft, though. Paul Gasol ended up going third. But that was the highest any international player had been picked. So maybe there was still a little bit of stigma there. But Shane Battier from Duke was there. Now, he's not a guy you would typically say go first, but he went sixth. And Shane Battier was, like, you knew, would be a perfect fit with Jordan. He was a mature player, as we saw throughout his career. He can step up when he has to, but he is a complete two-way player who could help. I know, I can't believe I'm discussing the 2001 NBA draft either. My point is, though, that LeBron bringing him in isn't the same as bringing Jordan in. But people just say that reflexively because they don't want to think about it. And this is what bothers me about this. To spin this towards football, the Stephon Diggs trade last week, right? So the deal basically is the Bills trade Stephon Diggs to the Texans for a 2025 second-round pick and then some other stuff. Houston gets, obviously, a receiver we're all familiar with, one of the better ones in the league historically, though he faded last year, and I've talked to some people who think that fade, it wasn't a one-off, that there was more, like, that's maybe he's a declining player. We'll see. They ended up voiding the last 2 years of the deal, so now Diggs is getting like $40-something million for 1 year, which is unbelievable. But this is also a young rising team who just acquired a player at a position. They have Nico Collins and Tank Dell. They don't really need help there, per se. Like, it's not at that, like, that level. But also a player who was just traded by a contender because that relationship had fractured significantly. My colleague Tim Graham wrote a really interesting column about this the other day. You can go check that out on The Athletic. So I get why Houston is being viewed as the team that won this trade. And that's fine. You can look at this objectively and say, or have a different opinion that, hey, maybe this is good for Houston. If Diggs can be that extra piece with all the other talent they have, maybe that's the ingredient they need to get over the top, even if it kind of muddles up things for fantasy owners. But then it's the other side of this deal, the reaction to it that I found frustrating, and that's with the Bills. The Bills giving up the player that we all know and only getting back picks had a lot of people going, well, this was a bad trade for them. So then you hear the Bills are taking out a $31 million cap hit because of this. Wow, why would you trade a guy who's really good and then take on the $31 million cap hit? Now, I didn't know this initially either. I had to look into it, but I did. He would have been a $28 million hit if he stayed, plus get his like $18 million in salary, and apparently, again, have this fractured relationship to deal with. Or they trade the pick, or they trade Diggs. They get an extra, they have to tack on an extra $3 million to the cap hit, so now it's 31 instead of 28. But they don't pay him a salary, and they get future picks. Also, it's at a position that you guys have heard me talk about this before. It's at a position that, while important, is kind of easily replaceable. Now, I'm not saying you can just get a guy like Stephon Diggs, peak Stephon Diggs in the draft, and that's like a guaranteed thing. But every year the draft is deep. No different here. The Bills have the 28th pick. They don't have to trade up to get somebody good. Now, they're not going to get Roma Dunze or Marvin Harrison picking at 28. They may not even get Brian Thomas, the kid from LSU. And now at that point, you're looking at guys like Adonai Mitchell and Ladd McConkey or whomever. And we talk about some of these guys with Nick. But that's okay, because when you have a quarterback like Josh Allen, who I'm not saying is Mahomes, but he is a difference maker at quarterback. I call these kind of guys, plus players, meaning it's not just a head-to-head comparison, your position versus my position. There's more here. You can go less elsewhere because you have more at the most important spot. So, of course, Buffalo has Curtis Samuel. They have tight end and Dalton Kincaid, who looked really impressive last year, and they've got some other pieces. In free agency, you still have Odell Beckham, you still have Hunter Renfro and others. My point is, you can go out and get people right now who can play and give you something. I couldn't say that really about, like, say, the tight end position with Washington in mind. this is not only a weak draft, it's always a, you know, it depends, you know, year to year. And there's nothing left in free agency that's going to be an obvious help. But none of that gets factored in. Everybody is just looking at the obvious. Stephon Diggs got traded, and that's sort of the only part of the deal. Therefore, the team that's receiving Diggs is going to win, especially if they don't give up a first-round pick, and you hear about these other matters. Again, you can think that Houston won the trade. I'm not arguing that. I'm arguing that the logic train that gets you there, or more importantly, that pins down the Bills, is my problem. And again, this is similar to the Wizards deal, because you're like, I'm not, again, disagree all you want, but what's the thought behind it? And I should have said this at the top, but I'm not talking, you know, you just want to be, you know, as a lot of my friends are, and great. We all grew up as a person who at some point, you know, was a casual fan, and you're just learning the game. And then, you know, if you really enjoy all this, you get more into it and you get more into it. And then you move sort of out of that casual thing because you are thinking about it a lot. You're invested in it a lot, whether it's emotionally or whether it's spiritually. You know, and don't get locked into something because that's either viewed as the norm out there, or it's viewed at, or, you know, you just haven't thought outside of that initial position. I often have said that, you know, I think a good part of being a thinker and a debater in these topics is make the argument for the side that you are going against. It's been said to me that, like, I'm a hater of Ted Leonsis. I've had colleagues say this, friends say this, and I vehemently disagree. To say I'm a hater would infer that no matter what he did, I would say bad move. I was the person who, when I covered the Wizards, that people, my friends, the people on the beat would call me the Ernie Grunfeld apologist, because I dare said, hey, you know what? This was a good move. Sure, they drafted Jan Vesely and they did these other things. They also did pick Bradley Beal at 3. And before you say, well, that was obvious, Charlotte didn't. They took Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, who faded out of the league. They made a mistake. The next pick was Deion Waiters, who had that, you know, sort of an up and down career. But, you know, Dame Lillard was like 2 picks after that, and Harrison Barnes was a little bit later. So give credit to the moves they make. When Bruce Allen was, you know, what he wasn't the scout kind of a GM, but he was the GM, but that position where you get credit or blame. Needless to say, Bruce Allen was a terrible era, lousy president, all that. They also, under him, drafted John Allen, Daron Payne, and Montez Sweat in 3 consecutive drafts, along with Dwayne Haskins. And if those picks were terrible, as other picks were, we blame that guy. Well, okay, if we're going to play that game, then you should give him credit for here. The last few years, you know, obviously not as good of drafts, and we pointed that out often. So if you want to be an emotional analyst, go ahead. Have fun, be the face painter, or just go all in, scream to the heavens about why you think your take is wrong. And this applies, of course, now to the quarterbacks as well, because they're going to make some pick. They're going to take somebody. And when that happens, some of you will be very upset because you wanted Drake May or you wanted Daniels or, you know, whatever. And that's fine. You can't, again, go nuts with the argument. But I guess it's just, for me, what hit this week, it was just such a fundamental misunderstanding of what is happening. And last one here, I'll say, is with regards to Caitlin Clark. Obviously, Iowa makes the NCAA final for the second year in a row, but loses. She's, you know, scoring a ton of points still. She is playing well. So the argument was, you know, I saw some people present is, I mean, you know, is she the best player? Is she the GOAT? It is a complete misunderstanding of what is actually taking place right now. We're not arguing, at least I'm not, and I don't think the reason we're all talking about Caitlin Clark is not because we're debating, is she the better player, or is it Diana Taurasi in college, or is it Breonna Stewart, or even like Paige Beckers right now, or Candace Parker, or whatever. What we're witnessing is a phenomenon, very similar to the way Steph Curry came into the NBA, or not came into the NBA, but when Steph Curry broke out with the Warriors. We had not seen this before. We've seen people shoot 3-pointers, but not to the degree with the range and the flair that he was doing it. We never argued if Steph Curry the best player in the league, not in any real way. Even at the peak of the Warriors, we weren't arguing that. He did win MVPs, but that's different than saying best player. That's most valuable by the definition. We always would say LeBron is better, Durant's better. Fine. Because it was a different deal. He was reshaping the game in ways that those guys didn't. Very, very few players ever in the history of sport reshape anything. Tiger Woods did it in golf. Steph Curry did it in the NBA. And Caitlin Clark has done it here. Also, like, into this conversation, like, I've seen people say, well, she didn't win a title. She can't be considered the greatest player of all time. Now, maybe that's where you lose a tiebreaker, you know, sort of like how Dan Marino, right? There was a point where Dan, it was like, you know, back in my day, like, and, you know, moving past the Johnny Unitas era, because if I don't see them, it's hard to judge and all that. But when it was like sort of a John Elway, Joe Montana, which of these guys, you know, kind of debate, Dan Marino was there, but he would lose the tiebreaker because of the fact he ultimately didn't win a title. I don't buy that. Like, John Elway only won two titles late in his career. He was still being viewed, certainly by me, as arguably the best quarterback I've ever seen. And I would still maintain that, you know, John Elway should be more part of this. We've now just given Tom Brady the best ever, and I don't really have an issue with that. But John Elway should be part of any conversation, not because he won the titles, but because how good he was. He took, yes, make fun of him for losing those four Super Bowls initially with Denver. Those teams should not even have been there. You all saw the Super Bowl with the commit with the Redskins and the Broncos. Come on. That Denver team was no good. He had no, I mean, you know, they made the Super Bowl, but like, he didn't have any star receivers around him. The defense was a mess, as Doug Williams showed. He carried that team to the end, just like Caitlin Clark carried Iowa to two finals back-to-back years. There is, I would be surprised if any of these Iowa players either make the WNBA or have any significant role. Whereas, like, say, on Connecticut, through the years with Tarazi, who's one of her teammates was Sue Bird, one of the greatest players ever. Breonna Stewart won the finals, college finals, all her four of her years. She was the best player, maybe is the best, you know, ever. I don't know. But, like, if you look at her roster, all her teammates are playing in the league or had played the league. That, where is that context? And also, again, more importantly, that's not what we're discussing. The Caitlin Clark phenomenon has gone so global that she's now gotten some haters, meaning, you know, there's pushback on this. She's a GOAT, and that's a good deal for the women's sport to have those conversations. But come on, the context is kind of important. It's not even close. What she is doing is incredibly unique. No disrespect to any of the South Carolina players or to Angel Reese or Paige Beckers, but like, we have seen that player come through the league many times, or the sport many times. The unique one, that is what we're discussing. And Caitlin Clark is much more in that Steph Curry range. And also, look, just in general, if you're dragging somebody because they made the finals 2 years in a row and didn't win, get out of here. That's insane. Again, especially when they are clearly amazing players and they didn't have teammates. You know, both in the two final four games, the other team was face guarding her. Do you know how unbelievably rare that is? Nobody face guards anybody. You have to be so out of whack in terms of the rest of the talent that a team is willing to essentially play 4-on-4 rather than have that player be involved in other parts of your defensive coverage. That is a sign right there of greatness. But again, that's not even what we're discussing. And so all these things that sort of happen simultaneously, I even could add in the people going hyper over the Adam Schefter report the other day. I shouldn't say report, the Adam Schefter point of view the other day, that all signs are pointing to Jaden Daniels. And oh my God, here we go again. Schefter knows what's going to happen. He knew that Ben Johnson wasn't going to be the guy. Here we go again. Well, yeah, no. He didn't say, sources tell me that the Commanders are zeroing on Jaden Daniels. He didn't say, sources tell me that GM Adam Peters is nuts for this kid. Or pick any of the other guys. No, everything is speculation. Tom Pelissero at the owners meeting. You know, I talked to a lot of people who know Adam Peters, and they said, based on knowing him, that they think the answer is J.J. McCarthy. Maybe that's right, but he's not reporting anything. He's just giving you a hunch based on his information. No different than I've been doing here. I've had Jaden Daniels as their pick at two for a month, and I have told you guys repeatedly, they're not talking, but I'm taking whatever information I have about the player and how I view the team and so on, and coming up with the best idea that I can. But when Schefter says these things, people report it as it's actually happening. I pulled up, I went on the internet the other day to pull up the quote, the actual quote, because I wanted to use it. And when I pulled it up, the Boston, it was a Boston.com story. I don't have the headline in front of me, but the headline, this is after Schefter made his comments on his podcast. The headline says, Schefter says Commanders favor Jaden Daniels, which of course wasn't true. And then that gets spread around. And now all of a sudden, people are only looking at the headlines or just hear or bad game of telephone. They think that's actually what happened. And no, it's not what happened. It might be what happens. They may pick Jaden Daniels, but that's not what happened. And like, I get it. We're all busy. And if the same stories are happening somewhere else, Atlanta, Detroit, whatever, I'm not paying as much of attention as I would be here. And so I see a headline or two, and I'm like, oh, that's weird, or that's interesting, or whatever. Maybe I never follow up. Maybe I never bother looking again. But I try to, because that's the whole point of this. And that's all I'm saying. Just, you know, keep an open mind to all this, especially you guys care about this number two pick in particular. Just keep an open mind as we're having these debates. All right, enough out of that. Thanks for listening to me get that off my chest and try to have that part of the conversation about how we talk about all these things. By the way, I ended up having to delay publishing this to the point that the eclipse has just happened. My neighbor had the glasses. I got a chance to look. Got to see pretty much, almost the full eclipse or whatever. You know, I saw what we're supposed to see. Cool. Glad I got to see it. And after about 20 seconds, I moved on and we're back here to wrap this up. So we'll do that. Thanks to Nick from does some work, it said, on Fantasy Points. Thanks to everyone here for checking out the podcast. More to come this week as we can move a little bit closer to the NFL draft. If you've missed any of the recent episodes, we've obviously had a ton of draft coverage. Chris Sims being the last one. A lot of free agency talk with Sheil Kapadia last week as well. So that is it for now. Ben Standick signing off. Until next time.